Blog Talk Radio.
All right, welcome everybody to the Aaron and Amy show. It's been a while. I think it's been 3 weeks or something. So, hi Amy, how's
hi.
It going? Yeah, we're missing the World Cup. I mean, it sucks, but the game's going on in the other room, and I'm missing it. But the good games are tomorrow anyway. I want to watch Brazil play tomorrow, and I don't think Amy watches the World Cup.
I have not been watching, pretty much anything. I've been very, very busy. So, Yaron, I know that this show is about talking about how bad the Trump presidency is and everything.
And, is that what the show is about?
Well, I mean,
that's what we get blamed for. We get accused for. Yeah. Okay.
But I got to tell you that I'm going to actually come out and say that I think the Trump presidency has been a good thing.
All right, you're going to have to do some big convincing because I'm not buying it yet.
Here's the main reason why I've decided, and it's because of everything that's been going on this week.
Yeah.
It is because this presidency has smoked out pragmatists like nothing I've ever seen in my entire life.
I think that's right, but what it's – so I agree with you in this sense. This presidency – is revealing people, or revealing a lot of people for what they really are in ways that I don't think we knew before. And it's reflecting the nature and the attitudes of the American people in ways that I don't think we knew before. But I don't think any of that is positive. That is,
I'm joking.
Yeah.
You know I'm joking.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it's smoking them out, but oh my God, there's so many of them, and like there's like three principled people
in
the whole universe.
Well, okay, that's one question
left.
I have for you. That's one question. Are there really so many of them, or are we being exposed to a lot more of them because of, you know, where we are on social media, our little bubbles and followers, and you know, I don't know. Of course, this week I've been inundated. But it doesn't necessarily mean that as a whole there's so many of them.
Well, I've been inundated for months and months and months. But, no, it is a good question, and I don't know the answer. I was listening to an interview that Sam Harris just did on the Dave Rubin show, which I strongly recommend. It's amazing to me the extent to which I agree with Sam Harris with regard to Trump. I mean, almost everything he says about Trump I agree with. So it really is – I found a real ally in Sam Harris in this regard. In other things, we disagree. But Sam points out that he's going off Twitter. He used to be constantly on Twitter all the time, and he kind of checks Twitter once a day, but he avoids it. And I think we are. I think we're captured by Twitter. Twitter, everything is instantaneous. People who you would have never heard from 5 years ago, now you hear from. So I don't know if what's happening is the state of the world is worse or that it's just more visible. I suspect it's worse just because I think it has to get worse. I think because of the state of philosophy, because of the state of politics, because of the state of the world, things have to get the culture, the American sense of life is going to get slowly degraded and worse. So I think we're capturing that, but in terms of numbers, right now, I just don't. Social media is very deceptive in that sense.
I mean, there's a couple things. There's who exists among our followers and people who we follow, and then there's also the fact that, you know, some people are more vocal than other people and are the ones who disagree and who are going to be very critical. But you know, I got a big dose of it yesterday, both from conservatives. There's a couple conservative actors who have followed me and generally been very friendly, and I've met both of them in person before, and they were pretty rude and condescending to me yesterday because I was criticizing Trump for morally sanctioning this brutal murderous thug dictator.
Which at least in objectivism is kind of objectivism 101. I mean, it's not this is
right
not
right now, you know, these guys are conservatives, they're not objectivists.
Yeah,
okay, fine, but still, it's, you know, I got this idea that these two guys did sort of represent some of the better parts of whatever's left of the American sense of life. And in a second, we're going to want to actually define for people who aren't familiar with that term, American sense of life. We want to talk about what that means.
Yep.
But
Well, somebody here is pointing out, look, but Steven Pinker says everything is better. And yeah, so let's be clear. I'm not saying everything is horrible. And, you know, I'm going to talk a lot about Steven Pinker's book at my talk at OCON. And I'd also talk about it on, I'll do a book review of the whole book on a show at some point. But no question, things are, you know, fantastic from a material sense. But in a global sense, things are much better. So the sense of life of the world is 100 times better. But when you narrow down to the United States, yes, things are still better economically, materially. But I think things are worse from a spiritual, from a sense of life perspective. And I think this president reflects that. And people's response to this president reflects that. And the other thing is, the other thing you mentioned social media. I mean, it's true, but it's also, look at his numbers in on the polls. I mean, they're not good.
He was just talking about that this morning.
But they're really not that bad. They're better than they were a few weeks ago, and they should be much worse. So the American people love him, or at least a certain committed segment loves him, and that seems to be growing. If you look across the board, you look at conservative criticism of him, there are not that many people criticizing him among conservatives. So you would expect, particularly the kind of foreign policy establishment, to really be going after him. Other than Commentary Magazine is really ripping him, and they're doing a really good job at it. Other than Commentary, I don't see anybody else really going after him. So, and the Republican Party across the board, senators, congressmen, are really rallying around him right now. So he is the Republican Party now. Whereas he was an outsider before, he's become the Republican Party. So, you know, there's a real cult of personality now around Trump. It's a real cultish kind of thing. There was a cult of personality around Obama, which the media led, and I think the left embraced. And now you're seeing the same thing on the so-called right. You're seeing the same thing among conservatives or among people who consider themselves conservative. And that's scary. That means that on both sides of the aisle, you're seeing on the political spectrum as we know it, you're seeing this cult of personality, you're seeing this authoritarianism.
In a way, I guess we have the different things that we focus on. You can tell me whether I'm not really, if I'm biased in what I'm about to say. But to me, I find this more disturbing because the cult of personality embraces pragmatism, embraces a methodology in a way that I don't think we've seen before. So with Obama, I think a lot of it was around the substance of what he did more than any particular methodology.
Yeah.
Whereas Trump is so brazen in his pragmatism, and his followers are just lockstep, at least in their arguing against me, in a pragmatist.
I mean, Greg on Facebook makes the point, and I think he's right, that it's worse than pragmatism. As bad as pragmatism is, because everybody's a pragmatist, right? In a sense, every politician, certainly since, I'm trying to think back, since Eisenhower, Kennedy, I mean, think about what Ayn Rand wrote about Kennedy, anti-intellectual pragmatist. Nixon was a complete, total, unabashed pragmatist. He was even a liar. I mean, they're all liars, right? They all lied. But Trump has taken it to another level. There's a certain sense in which I don't care that I lie. I'm a bullshitter, and I don't care that I bullshit. And I'm president of the United States, and that doesn't matter. I can get away with anything. I shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue. I can praise a monster. I can do all these things, and nothing matters. And it doesn't. It's not that nothing matters just to his followers. Nothing matters to him. You always got a sense, even with Bill Clinton, the ultimate liar, right? That he kind of felt embarrassed about lying, and he felt like he needed to pretend he wasn't lying.
Mm-hmm.
Trump doesn't pretend. I mean, he said at the press conference after meeting the monster, he said something like, 6 months from now, this could all turn out to be a failure.
Right.
And then he stops himself and I said, oh, no, but I'll find an excuse. I will never admit that to you guys. And then I don't know if you read what he said about the New York Times. Did you read about this?
It's okay to lie to them because it's just the fake news media or whatever. Yeah.
Here's he says somebody told him, told him, you lied about this thing. And he, you know, I put aside what the actual item was. He says, that's irrelevant. It's a statement to the New York Times. The phony, failing New York Times. That's not a statement to the High Tribunal of Judges. That's a statement to the phony New York Times. In other words, it's okay to lie to the New York Times. It's okay to lie to the American people, in other words. It's okay to lie to anybody. And yes, that's pragmatism, right? If I can get away with it, it's okay. But he's not even trying to get away with it. He admits to it. And he says, yeah, you know, who cares? But, you know, and what are the people justifying him say? He's playing 4D chess.
Yeah.
He's so much smarter than all of us that he's thought about seven moves into the future, and his lies meant to manipulate the North Koreans in a particular way as to succeed in his goal. I mean, there is a certain disdain for the American people. There's certainly a disdain for him, his own life. I mean, I've always said he has no self-esteem. He has a negative self-esteem. There's a disdain for himself, disdain for reality, disdain for the American people. I mean, Greg says it's almost nihilistic. I think that's right. But you know, and Obama was nihilistic in a certain sense, and that's the thing. The pragmatism is turning into this ugly nihilism, this ugly. You know, I don't care about reality. I don't care about truth. You know, fake news. I am fake news. We're producing fake news. And at the end of the day, this all fits into what we at the Institute have been saying from day one, which is this is a move towards authoritarianism. This is
right.
This is,
and I went ahead and I put that article yeah. in the program notes just for people to go back and revisit. But let's back up a little bit.
Can I do this quote or do we go? Do we want to get to this later? The authoritarian one from
Friday. The authoritarian one is something really to look at and just see.
No, this is a quote from his interview with Fox or something. I don't. Yes, Fox and Friends.
Okay.
I think it's Fox and Friends. Anyway, this is what he says. Mm-hmm. Right, verbatim, and he's talking about the monster. He says, he is the head of a country, and I mean he is a strong head. Don't let anyone think anything different. And then this is what he says. He speaks and his people sit up at attention.
Mm-hmm.
I want my people to do the same. I mean, chills go down my spine.
Now listen. So I this is the discussion that I had. And this is what got these two actors just being so contemptuous of me on Twitter yesterday. These people who are nice, you know, and at the end, one of them kind of pats me on the back and says, oh, I'm still a fan of yours, Amy, you know, as if,
yeah.
you know, he's gotten
yeah.
the better of me, he
yeah.
thinks, and everything else.
Yeah.
It's really sad. But some people have come back and they said, oh, well, he's just talking about the people who work for him. And my point is that even if he's talking about his direct reports or people who work for him, the American president does not want that type of obedience. That type of obedience is obedience that comes from fear.
Yeah.
It is not the type of obedience that comes from respect. I mean, you know, I was going to make a whole joke with you. I work with you, and you don't want me to sit there and just obey.
Absolutely.
You want
just
me to
sit up and
my...
sit at attention. You know, and he loves the military. He loves the military, and he says he expresses that. But no, this is not about his direct reports. This is about his people. He talked about Kim, the monster, loving his people. He talked about
right.
that as well, which is a travesty. But think about what he's saying. He's talking about, and this was in, you know, this is exactly what he, you know, he is referring to the North Korean people, and he wants the American people to sit up and pay attention to him. And think about what that means. Think about the fact that the North Koreans pay attention to Kim, because if they don't, they go to a prison camp or concentration camp. Think mm-hmm. about the fact that they pay attention to him because they can't leave. They can't go anywhere because they've been brainwashed to view him as an idol, as a god. You know, and add this to his admiration and respect and constant positive accolades against towards Xi of China. And towards Putin in Russia, and the picture and his dancing with the kings of Saudi Arabia, and it just all adds up to this guy. Whether put aside his intentions or what he wants, he loves strongmen. He loves people, and this is you know, he probably runs his business this way. He loves the idea that he just, he gets stuff done. To hell with division of, you know, powers, to hell with the constitutional government, just get stuff done. And these guys, people sit at attention and they get stuff done. Nobody talks back to them. The Congress doesn't overrule them. You get stuff done. And this is exactly how you slip into dictatorship. It's American people are frustrated because nothing's happening. American people's frustrated because Congress is meandering and there's gridlock and nothing gets done. So they say, okay, we just need somebody to get stuff done. And that's how you get a dictator. You don't get a dictator from people clamoring for a dictator. You get a dictator from people clamoring for, we want something to get done. And this statement of his is just so shocking. And the fact that I haven't seen a single Republican criticize him.
I had people try to yesterday separate. They'd say, oh, yeah, well, he wants that attention, but you could get attention like that in a legitimate way. And I'm saying, no, the type of attention that he was jealous of Kim Jong-un for was the type of attention that comes from people who are fearing for their lives.
Let's be clear. You cannot get that attention in a free country.
No.
You cannot get that attention in a free country. You cannot compare the two. You don't have, you know, a good president deserves respect. He does not deserve obedience. A true president deserves you listening to him. He does not deserve sitting at attention.
Yeah,
right?
This is where I was inspired to go look back at the essay Don't Let It Go, because one of the things that Rand talks about in there is that when Americans regard celebrities, but also politicians, she talks about in there, we give respect, but respect as equals, as people who have earned whatever position. And she talks about how we refer to our presidents using their initials and things, and it's, you know, it's an affection, but that we see them as equals. It's not as this person that we're afraid of and that we revere. And, you know, again, even if it was just his own staff that he was hoping would be that way, you don't want that if you are someone who's got the American spirit, because the American spirit is going to reward initiative. This is another thing that Rand talks about again in the essay Don't Let It Go. She wrote it in 71, but she talks about the various characteristics of what she calls the American sense of life, and roughly the way that I will define it, because she defines it in very technical philosophical terms. The American sense of life is the American attitude towards human nature, human ability to achieve success in the world, the position of an individual human being vis-a-vis a government, you know, how you see yourself in society and in the world in general, how happy and optimistic you are. That's generally how it is. But there's a list of characteristics that I want to go through with you. But one of them is, of course, this idea of seeing politicians as equals, not as, you know, the sit at attention attitude. And another thing that she talks about in there is how Americans have initiative, that Americans are not about obedience.
Yes.
That, you know, if I'm on a show with you and I think you're wrong, I'm not going to sit in my place and just be quiet or whatever because, you know, it's your show. I'm going to speak my mind. And you as an American would want me to do that. You would reward that. You would say, yeah, I want somebody who.
Well, and that's why we give Americans the vote, right? We give people the ability to vote with the idea that they have an opinion and that opinion needs to be expressed. And in a sense, they have the same ability to express it as anybody else because one person, one vote. North Korea doesn't have that, right? And there's a reason for that, because they don't respect the point of view of any individual. To them, it's meaningless, and authoritarians don't care. And I don't think Trump cares. I think Trump only cares about his own opinion. He only cares about, you know, I don't think he really has that much opinions. I think he mainly cares about the attention. He mainly cares about the positive accolades more than anything else. I don't think it's like he's striving towards some great goal that he's trying to attain. But yes, we believe that politicians are just like us. You know, maybe they have specialized knowledge, but generally they're just like us. And that the essential American characteristic is to speak up. It's to resist authority. It's to resist any kind of authoritarian bent, to stand up against any authority and to express oneself and one's opinions.
Yeah, and the quotation that I used that got everybody so upset was the quotation from Rand, defiance, not obedience,
yes,
is the American response to,
yes,
overbearing authority. The, you know, the, that's what the American does. The European supposedly shuts up and obeys. Now, it's, you know, it's telling that she thought we had to compare Americans versus Europeans, but now we're looking at...
Well, I think there's very little difference today between Americans and Europeans. I mean, I know people are going to call me an America hater, as they have many times, but the fact is that America has declined faster in its sense of life. Europe didn't have much to decline because it didn't have much to begin with. There's a convergence. America's becoming more and more like Europe. There's a good one from Michael here. He says, what we should tell Trump is, no, I see you're a little confused here, Mr. President. Here, let me help you out. It's we the people speak, and you, the government, sits up at attention.
Right.
Good one, Michael. That's right.
No, and I would say that to the extent that all of us didn't think of that immediately, we're letting some of it erode in,
yes,
us as well,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Because I'm sitting here thinking, oh yeah, why didn't I think of that?
Yeah.
At least I'm protesting against this, but I didn't go as far as I should have gone with it, right?
Let me. I just want to comment on this 4D chess, sure, stuff because it comes up all the time. Let me just say something. What evidence, any evidence, some evidence, a little bit of evidence, that suggests that he's playing 4D chess?
I've got one bit. I was thinking about this. There's one bit, which is if he truly has this idea that it's okay to lie to achieve ends, because some people were speculating pretty much arbitrarily that in all this praise of Kim Jong-un, maybe it's just a lie in order to, you know, butter him up and get whatever it is that Trump has in mind getting.
It might be.
No, we know that he's willing to lie and that he just
He once said, I don't have the direct quote here, but there was a point where, you remember, he was calling Kim all these names and you know, we're going to blow you up and we're going to kill you all, guys, Rocket Man. And then he suddenly flipped and they started negotiating. And he suddenly said, I could be best friends with Kim. And somebody asked him, how can you? And he said, I can hate somebody. And then on a flip of a dime, I can turn and love them. I have no problem on just switching completely from one extreme to another. It doesn't mean anything to me. So, yes, I don't think anything means anything to him. I think he just says stuff. And I don't think I don't think that means there's a grand plan. I just think that he just responds to stimuli. You know, the stimuli at the beginning was we're going to butt heads and, okay, I'm good at that. And then the stimuli was, we might be able to arrange a summit or something. Oh, okay, now I love the guy. I want to go and have a summit with him. And now I think he's just fantastic. He's this great human being. And in 2 weeks, he could flip completely on this. He could be calling him Rocket Man again. I don't think it's not 4D chess. It's just concrete bound, zero attention span, right here, right now mentality. This pure pragmatism. He's more pragmatist than any pragmatist before him in that sense. And that's what's driving this. There's no 4D chess. There's nothing to suggest. I don't know if there is such a thing as 4D chess, but 3D chess, 2D chess, any chess, because that kind of chess would suggest that he's got all these moves laid out. Then where were the moves when he was going to get rid of Obamacare? Where were the moves when he was going to cut government spending? Where were the moves when he needs to get Congress to pass an immigration bill? Where are all these 4D? There's actually no evidence that Trump has gotten anything he really, really, really wants across except tax cuts, which every single Republican president, as far back as I remember, certainly since Eisenhower, has done, and even Democrats didn't object to cutting corporate taxes. So it was the easiest thing in the world to do. Other than that, he's gotten nothing through his so-called, you know, negotiation skills.
No, and so I would say it's not arbitrary to say that, yeah, he's willing to lie, and he thinks it's okay to lie to Kim Jong-un, that would be okay. But what is arbitrary in the people assertions that I've read about this. You know, they think, oh, well, you know, he's just lying to him in order to achieve some grand plan.
No.
What is arbitrary is the grand plan.
Yes, there's no grand plan. I mean, yeah, he thinks that.
I don't have any evidence of that.
So I think, I mean, my sense is he met with Kim. Kim was charming. They kind of had a conversation. He's this young kid. He rules a country. Whoa, people love him. They sit at attention when he walks into the door. You know, when he arrived in Singapore, people stood at the streets and were, you know, just a sickening sight. And Trump goes, yeah, this kid's kind of cool. Okay. Let's go with it, right? So I don't think that he's saying, oh, if I suck up to him, then he'll be nice, then he'll be more open to this. No, he's saying, oh, I mean, I think if Kim had come in and been obnoxious and being rude, and then I think Trump would have said, oh, what a horrible person this Kim is. No, Kim was kind of nice. And so again, Trump is zero attention span, concrete bound right now. Kim was a nice guy. You know, so he slaughters people in the background. You remember what he said about
Putin? He said, I judge him on the last week or two or something.
Yeah.
Do you remember
then,
that part?
Yeah, yeah. You judge him on the last week or two. But even on the last week or two, it turns out that before Kim came to Singapore, he cleaned house. And when somebody said that he fired a bunch of people, top eight, then Trump kind of jokingly said, well, you say he fired. Fired may be a nice word. You know, he did something much worse than just fire them. And Trump knows this, so that's even in the last week or two. But you remember what Trump said, and I've seen this on Twitter too, what Trump said when Putin, somebody confronted him with Putin and said, you know, Putin kills journalists, murders journalists, which is absolutely true. Trump said, yeah, we all kill people. I mean, America's killed people. So
right,
what's the big deal?
Right.
And that was during the campaign, and nobody cared.
That was one of the things,
that,
you know, again, when I was going through Don't Let It Go,
yeah,
that really
disqualified him from being president in my mind.
There's one of the qualities that, and we should go through this. Okay.
Yeah,
because
okay.
I had two sort of purposes in mind in going through these different characteristics that she says compose the American sense of life.
Okay. So remind us what the first two was and let's go to the next.
Well, right. So, but the two sort of things I have in mind is, first of all, people who are Trump supporters, just think for yourself whether you agree that being American in your mind does encompass these various characteristics in a certain way. Do you think that having these characteristics as Americans has value? And then think about, you know, to what extent Trump is helping to erode these various things, you know, just think about, have people just think about it. I want to appeal to Trump supporters, say to them that these characteristics have value, that they are in danger of being eroded under the type of support that Trump is getting, this authoritarian bent that people are on, and also the pragmatism. So there's that. And then the second thing, just for you, Yaron, is this is a challenge for you because you've got this lecture coming up at the conference,
yeah,
where you have to be a rational optimist. And I'm asking you to look at these characteristics and whether they're alive and well among the American people. And, or, you know, you could say in the world too, and maybe that's going to be the thing that's going to save you. You're going to be
well,
optimistic.
One of my escape patches is I'm declaring myself a globalist.
Okay. but again, it's facing up to what's the state of the American sense, yeah, of life. Okay. So let's go through. Americans see themselves as independent entities versus, you know, she was comparing to Europeans at the time. Europeans see themselves as subservient to a state. Do we as Americans see ourselves as independent entities, or are we more,
well, again,
America
I think
first, nationalism?
We've
right?
drifted towards nationalism. We've drifted mm-hmm. to American jobs. We've drifted to an American border. We've drifted to a wall. We've drifted to all these nationalistic symbols. They're not even, nationalism has no meaning, but all these nationalist symbols. I mean, I noticed that with McCain coming out of the Republican convention in 2008, with the slogan country first, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that,
right,
you know, McCain's not exactly a Trumpite, but even he is a nationalist to some extent, you know, and the idea of country first. Now, Trump has taken that and put it on steroids, but the whole tariffs, the whole, all of this is, yes, talking about American jobs is nationalistic. Somebody's asking me, absolutely. There's no such thing as an American job. There's my job, there's your job, the people I hire, the people you hire. There's no such thing as an American job. There's no such thing as an American product. There's no such thing. All these things are stupid. There's a product made by Fiat and a product made by Chrysler. Chrysler is actually owned by Fiat. There's a product made by Toyota that might have made it in a factory in the United States. There's a product made by Ford that might have made it in Mexico with a Mexican employee. So is the product a Mexican product or an American product? All of this is bullshit. There is no such thing. There is your life. There's somebody else's life. You might have a job. I might have a job. We can talk about the American system, and we can talk about the American geography, and we can talk about whether the American system promotes job creation or not, promotes wealth creation or not. But the idea of an American job and the idea of structuring policy in order to enhance American jobs is nationalistic, collectivistic, anti-American. It's anti-American. The goal of government is to protect individual rights. There's nothing there about American jobs. There's nothing in the Constitution about American jobs. There's nothing in the Constitution much about America. There is about protecting the rights within the geography that's defined as America, protecting the rights of individuals to live their lives based on their reasoning to the best of their ability and to protect that from coercion. That is what is America. It's not GDP. It's GDP. All of these terms and all of our economic discussions are corrupting because they lead towards this kind of nationalistic, collectivistic thinking. And Trump and this election have elevated that to the ultimate. And again, the discussion on tariffs and the discussion of immigration are probably the best examples of that.
And the other thing I would say in this regard is the whole discussion around that you're not supposed to take a knee to the flag.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, why not? Why not? What the hell, right? If the flag is now representing something I don't like, absolutely. And taking a knee is a respectful way of demonstrating, of saying something's wrong in the country. You might disagree with what they're doing, but what they're doing is actually respectful. It's not spitting at the flag. It's not burning the flag. It is actually taking a knee and saying, hey, I think there are real problems here. And we all acknowledge that there are problems.
And his problem with people taking a knee integrates perfectly with the idea that he wants everybody to just sit up and pay attention to him, right? He just wants you to sit up at attention and be loyal and obedient, like he talks about in his tweet this morning. Yep. And everything. He doesn't want the independence of Americans. Next one, respect for money that's earned by personal effort versus in England, the respect for old money. And I would say today, maybe in America, the thing that we would worry about is, are we having respect for money that's earned in a crony way? Because when I think of Trump, I think of people talk about, oh, he's got, you know, this great business acumen and we're supposed to admire him for the fact that he's been a successful businessman. But how much of what he has earned in his life has been through cronyism?
It's hard to tell, just to play, you know, it's hard to be in the real estate business. It's impossible to be in the real estate business without having to deal with government. You have to. Mm-hmm. Everything in real estate is determined by government, the city planners, city engineers. So, but there are degrees of involvement, the degrees of bribery or campaign funding. Or
but like
you
declaring
want to call
bankruptcy all the time. For
yeah, but again, that's using the legal system. But yeah, no, I think he's very crony. But I don't want to suggest that that you can do real estate without being somewhat crony. Everybody has to be somewhat crony. But there's also so there's that. What surprises me about Trump is the number of so-called libertarians, free marketers, objectivists who admire Trump because he's a businessman without identifying the fact that he's a crony to the extent that he is and differentiating. And I think
we could say there's like sort of there's an indifference to whether or not the money's coming from a crony.
There is, but then what you see, and this is the challenge, right? Then what you see is the same people going after Silicon Valley, where there are people who are really making money and really creating wealth and really doing exciting new things. And the least crony in the entire economy, and going after them for being cronies. So there's a tribalism that says because people in Silicon Valley are on the left, they're bad, and we just, you know, we just need to find the excuse of exactly why they're bad. And then there's also the thing that Trump, because he's on our side, he's good, and therefore he's good. So I think the attitude towards money is worse than it was, and I think it's negative, although there's still a lot in American culture that admires Silicon Valley. Put aside, you know, the tribe that hates him, but put aside the general respect that exists in American culture for Silicon Valley. That is a respect still for entrepreneurs, respect for wealth creation. But it's, you know, I think one could argue it's in decline.
Okay. Envy. To what extent is envy present among American people now versus...
Oh, it's a huge difference. I mean, the whole, you could see this in the last 10 years, probably less, maybe 8 years, certainly since the financial crisis, with the whole discussions of inequality, which is completely driven by envy and disguised envy. These discussions didn't happen nowhere near as much 30, 40, 50 years ago, certainly not 100 years ago. It is much, much more of a resentment for people being wealthy because they're wealthy, a much, much more resentment of so-called inequality that is driven by envy. So I actually think here we've really gone a long way negatively. And there's a belief.
One example I think of, and I haven't went on the Drudge for so long. I don't go on Drudge anymore. But Drudge would have these headlines about Apple is escaping certain taxes or whatever, as if it's like, some horrible thing for Apple, this productive company, to get out of paying some taxes. I think envy is exhibited among
that's a combination, though, but that's also nationalism, right? Because your job, your responsibility, is to pay taxes. You have to pay in, and this is the whole thing about. You remember those reverse mergers where companies were getting established in other countries so they could pay for lower taxes. And that was offensive to Trump and offensive to everybody and Obama. But that was also a form of nationalism. That was, you know, how dare they leave America? And, you know, today, if you're wealthy and you leave the United States, you give up your citizenship. You have to pay a special tax. So there's a special tax now. This is called the Schumer Amendment. Schumer passed this. Republicans voted for it. That you have to pay a tax to give up your American citizenship and leave the country. So there's generally this idea that funding the government now is elevated to a new status, whereas in the past we tolerated government, we tolerated paying taxes. Nobody was happy with paying taxes, but you know, we need a government, and the government did a few things, and some of them were good, and we tolerated. Now you're supposed to pay it all. You know, how dare Apple use loopholes to pay less taxes, right?
And supposedly free market leaning people like Drudge are ones complaining about this, which has gotten me. Now, we talked about having respect for our public figures and our government officials, but as equals. We talked about Americans having a sense of initiative, of jumping into solving problems and making suggestions as opposed to keeping one's place, obedience. There's another thing here. The idea of having different stores that different classes of people shop in, that's not a very big one. I don't know if you have any sense on that.
The idea of choice, the idea of having lots of choices and relishing choices.
In Europe, it used to be at least that
not anymore.
If you were in the upper class and you were caught shopping at the 5 and 10 or whatever, it would be scandalous.
Yeah,
but
right.
In the United States, everybody shops everywhere. Walmart doesn't matter.
I think there's, to some extent, I think there's more segregation today in America than there was maybe when Ayn Rand wrote this. There is a sense in which some people shop at Walmart and some people shop at Saks Fifth Avenue. And there is more of a differentiation and more of a distinction like that. Hard to tell. And Europe has gotten better in that regard, I think. I think there's Europe is far less class conscious than it used to be. And somebody said here, oh, not all Europeans, you know, da, da, da. Yeah, no, I know. We're generalizing. I think Europe has gotten better, right?
Well, she was talking about 1971 as well. So
I think Europe, in some respects, has gotten much better over the last 30, 40 years than, you know, so in respect of the individual wanting to live his own life and not wanting to be told and shopping wherever and I think there are more people concerned about liberty today in Europe. So I think Europe at the margin has gotten a little bit better. And again, the world has gotten a lot better. It's just the United States that's gotten worse because the United States was so much better than everywhere else 100 years ago and possibly even 40, 50 years ago.
Okay, so here's a big one. There's a section in the essay where she talks about, you know, there's a quotation from someone saying the Americans are so happy. And this is contrasted with what she lists, the number of characteristics that Europeans at the time she thought possessed.
Yeah.
Mysticism, lethargic resignation, a cult of suffering, misery and impotence as man's fate, unhappiness as the hallmark of a sensitive spirit.
Yeah.
Those were qualities that Europeans had, you know, she thought at the time, and Americans rejected. What came to your mind? Because something definitely came to my mind when I was looking at that list. Did anything?
Well, mysticism, obviously, you know, is a challenge in the U.S. But I mean, what comes to my mind is that Europe is really better than it used to be. That is, I think there's less of that in Europe. I mean, it's still there. It's still dominant, but there's less of it. And in the United States, there's more of the opposite. But the idea of the pursuit of happiness, I think one of the great achievements of America is the exportation of the idea of the pursuit of happiness. That is that the pursuit of happiness now is global. I think that you know, this is why 50 years ago, if you were in Guatemala and there were gangs and there was brutal violence and there was all this stuff, you just stayed in Guatemala. That was life. You know, there was nothing else. What could you do? I think that today, and I know people are going to hate me for this. Today, the fact that these Guatemalan parents grab their baby, walk thousands of miles to come to America is a sign that people now embrace the idea that it's possible as an individual to be happy. They realize that they can't be happy where they are, and they leave. So that used to be Europe, right? In Europe, they used to, in the 19th century, early 20th century, it was obvious they couldn't be happy where they was. They got their stuff, and they packed up, and they went to America. But South Americans didn't do that, right? Central Americans didn't do that, certainly not in the numbers. But now, even in Latin America, certainly in Central America, and because of television and because of the internet, it's like, wait a minute, people over there look happy. You know, I want to be happy too. And of course, they get here, and we take their baby, and we put their baby in a little concentration camp. Now, I shouldn't say concentration camp, facility.
An old Walmart.
An old Walmart, but in a facility. Concentration camp is too, you know, hysterical. But in a Walmart, in a facility, and we put the parents in jail, and we keep them separated. Wow. I mean, you know, this is America. So I think the world, again, I'm going to say the world, I think, is better. I think if you're born right now in a village in northern Thailand, 100 years ago, you knew that you were going to be forever in a village in northern Thailand, and that was life, and it's going nowhere, and nothing will happen, right? And
So we've exported initiative and pursuit of happiness is what you're saying. So let me do the other side, right, which is how bad it's gotten here. And I'll tell you what came to my mind when I was looking at this. It was, you know, who is the most popular leading intellectual, the one that is making everybody so supposedly optimistic?
Well, it's Jordan Peterson.
Right, now. Yeah. Right, Jordan Peterson. And what does Jordan Peterson tell you? That life is about suffering. One of the things she's talking about is the cult of suffering.
Yeah, he's
the
very misery, European.
Misery and impotence is man's fate. And this is what Peterson preaches. You know, he talks about the different rules that you can follow to make your life better on the margin, so to speak. But all you're going to be doing is relieving suffering, which is really the essence.
I think that's right. I'm hopeful in a sense. I hope that I'm right, that I think that the people who go to see him and the people who idealize him are not doing it because of his emphasis on suffering, but because he's offering a way out, that they're still pursuing happiness. By the way, people are so negative about Europe, and granted, there are a lot of problems in Europe, and Europe in many respects is a basket case. And yet, you know, I was just in Spain, and Spain's a basket case, an insane place, right? You know, people are out there on the beaches, they're shopping, they're living a good life, they're trying to, you know, I went to some great restaurants. The idea that Europe is this dark, crumbling, you know, filled with Muslims everywhere, you know, and the, you know, people live in constant fear and are huddled in corners. That's just bizarre. I mean, you were just in Amsterdam and Copenhagen.
Yeah, no, I didn't see that at all. Celebrations of victory and freedom.
Yeah, and I was in Spain, and I've been all over Europe, you know, constantly in Europe. And yeah, Europe is a basket case, but the lives of individual young Europeans, you know, are pretty good, and they seem just as happy and engaged and motivated as many Americans. That they're less because there's a certain, I think Ayn Rand's right about the certain European, you know, fatalism, but this idea that Europe is just on the verge of, I'll talk about this in my optimism talk, right? Because the idea that the world is on the verge of becoming Islamic, on the verge of falling over a cliff, on the verge of total collapse, and that everybody's a basket case is absurd. Part of the basket case that is Europe right now is this dangerous and scary shift towards nationalism, a return to European roots in real collectivism, nationalism, and statism. And that's scary. You're seeing it in Italy.
And that's certain of the countries, though, not all of them.
Yeah, and
right?
That's not all the countries. But you know, it's most of the countries. I think most of the countries have a significant rise in that. You know, we'll ask, what happens to Europe when the euro implodes? Is the euro going to implode before the dollar? I mean, I've heard that so many times. I remember an objectivist intellectual who bet me, when the euro was established, he bet me that the euro would, I can't say, go down in value versus the dollar to pennies on the dollar, right? And I said, no way. I mean, no way is that going to happen.
Did you bet anything significant, and did you get anything?
And he got no, because, you know, I'll tell you who the guy was afterwards, and you'll understand why I got nothing. But on the contrary, the euro actually got stronger as compared to the dollar, and still stronger than the dollar from where it started out. And the idea that the euro is just going to implode tomorrow, and the euro is not a sign of collectivism. I mean, it is no more sign of collectivism than the dollar is. I mean, again, people are looking at the wrong things and at the wrong symbols and at the wrong enemies and this is the biggest problem in the world.
Collectivism. How about the anti-Semitism that I got on Twitter last night? You know, I told you, and I put a
and
sample on
you're not even
this.
Jewish. What's up with
well,
that?
Well, I've got the name, and so then they always associate me. And then, of course, now if you're an objectivist, they always associate objectivism because it's, quote, founded by Jews, and I mean, it just goes on. But like I said, during the day yesterday was difficult because of these conservative actors and their followers piling on.
Yeah.
But then in the evening, it's like these anti-Semites come out. It's really.
Well, it means you're doing something, Amy. I think it's a sign of success.
Yeah. I definitely struck a nerve with some of these talks. But you know, I think it's because even they getting disturbed by what Trump is doing, it's like they're a little bit more frantic and insistent in their defense of him because I think part of them understands that this is really wrong. This fawning over Kim Jong-un is wrong. One of the actors, it's just a stylistic point. The fawning is a stylistic point.
We've got the anti-Semites on Twitter going right now. So don't worry about it.
Okay.
And they're on every time I do a show.
You mean on YouTube?
On YouTube, sorry, not on Twitter. Yeah, YouTube. Yeah. Every time I do a show, the anti-Semites come out. So it's part of the ugly culture that is social media.
There's your real collectivism, really nasty, dirty form of collectivism. So let's go back to this list again. So let's focus on these things having been part of the characteristic attitude of Americans, and that it's, you know, what's the prize here? The prize is that Rand says that this set of characteristics, even though it doesn't amount to an explicitly held philosophy and an ability to defend the American system on philosophical terms, it nonetheless has been enough to stave off totalitarianism all of this time. That Americans have this set of characteristics that amounts to an implicit grasp of the type of philosophy that's necessary to defend our system, defend us from totalitarian dictators. So this is, you know, again, everybody judge for themselves. I'm listing the characteristics that she thought in 1971 were relevant to look at.
Yep.
You ask yourself, you know, to what extent are these healthy and alive among American people or among people anywhere? And to what extent do you think they are truly relevant for preserving the right to pursue happiness? This is my concern, right? This is why I called my blog Don't Let It Go. Don'tletitgo.com is my blog where you find the program notes after this essay, because this set is important. And I've told my listeners this. I've personally had a struggle to keep these characteristics alive in myself. Okay, I've seen this, and why? It's because I've grown up in this country that's in decay. So, continuing with the list, Americans are self-confident, trusting, generous, enormously benevolent, and innocent, versus Europeans having a sense of original sin and Europeans internalizing not only the existence of evil, you know, acknowledging that evil does exist, but Europeans believing in the power of evil.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell. I think that, yeah, it's definitely in decline in the U.S. And this is with the rise, I think, of the evangelicals in the 1980s. You saw an increase in this idea of original sin and kind of the whole Christian idea of. But I think Americans are still ahead on this one. I think Americans are still pro-life, enjoying life. I mean, you go anywhere, and again, you go in America, you meet average Americans. I think the one thing that's different, this she doesn't mention, but I think it's characteristic now of many Americans kind of in middle America, and many of the people on Twitter and many of the people on Facebook that you see and the Trump supporters, is how angry they are. So the two emotions that I think dominate the Trump era are fear and anger. Fear of losing jobs, fear of using American whatever, manufacturing jobs, fear of Muslims.
Nuclear war yesterday, nuclear war. I'm told I'm for nuclear war.
Yes, I've been told that all the time. Fear of immigrants, fear of nuclear war, fear of crime rampaging in our streets, fear of decay. And some of this fear is justified. So some of the fear is, yeah, there's something wrong in the world today. There's something wrong. The culture's not like it used to be. America's not as strong and not as confident and all these things, right? So there's a certain level of justification for the fear. They're identifying something true, but it's blown out of proportion and targeted at the wrong things. And then the consequence of not understanding the fear and not understanding what to do about it and not understanding its source – and feeling betrayed by the elites who should be explaining and articulating the reasons and the solutions, and people feel betrayed by the elites because they haven't. Then that results in anger. So we're angry because we're afraid, and people betray us. And finally, Donald Trump at least acknowledges our anger and our fear. At least Donald Trump says, "Yeah, you're right to be fearful." You're right, and here are the causes. He explains it to us. He tells us that we really should fear the Mexicans. They really are the bad guys. And then he gives us a simple explanation, and he justifies our anger. So to me, that's the explanation of his victory. It's Americans today, or a significant number of them. Again, it's dangerous to generalize. A significant number of Americans are fearful and angry. And both. There's an element of truth too. They should be fearful of certain things. They're just fearful about the wrong things. And they should be angry. And they should be angry at their intellectuals, because the intellectuals have fed them a lot of shit for forever, right? But instead of searching and discovering the better intellectuals, the people who've been explaining what's going on and what the solutions are forever, like Ayn Rand, they instead, elites are out, intellectuals are out, we're not interested in that. You know, we just want somebody to get the job done, right? We just want to get the job done. So, this one, of all the ones, I think the thing that Americans are less American about is this fear and anger.
Self-confidence, being trusting, generous, enormously benevolent and innocent.
It's another one that's hard, right? Because when you're fearful and when you're angry, it's hard to be trusting and benevolent. And if you look at the immigration debate, there's no better debate to see that there is, that the benevolence is out. The benevolence is gone. What benevolence? I mean, illegal immigrants, shoot them all. You know, these little kids, send them back to Guatemala, separate them from their parents, let them cry. Who cares? Wow. I mean,
yeah. One thing I'm going to say about me, thankfully, is I was called naive yesterday on Twitter. So I'm.
Well, somebody's asking why you're for nukes, and I'll tell the reason is that there are only two options. One is negotiate with Kim and get him to denuclearize, or nuclear war. Those are the two options.
Yeah, those are the only two.
Options. And all over Facebook, on my feed, on Facebook and on Twitter, I've been told that those are the only two options. Good for Trump for choosing the peaceful one. I've got this from libertarians. I've got this from objectivists. I've got the only two options. Negotiate with Kim, the monster, or nuclear war. And that's absurd.
Well, okay. So first of all, I agree with you, obviously. Can you tell people, you were talking on your show the other day about where you have laid out a detailed solution that you think is possible to this. It's a military solution. I think you said it's very expensive. It's not.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't for a military solution, but I have a military solution. If people are interested, mm-hmm. It's one of my podcasts in the past. Just look North Korea in the podcast app, and I think you'll find it. I don't think it's on YouTube.
There's some attitude that I'm getting even from people who are, you know, fans of Ayn Rand and followers of me and stuff, which is that, you know how James Taggart in Atlas Shrugged, he'll come up to Dagny and just say, hey, we know that we've messed this up with our policies forever. You're supposed to fix it. Now, it's not that these followers of mine on Twitter or whatever think that I've created the problem. But nonetheless, they have this idea about, you know, if you don't have a solution to this great problem, you know, this problem that everybody else has created, and you can't come in with the perfect immediate solution that's going to be as, quote, effective as Trump's right away, then somehow there's something wrong with you for pointing out the fact that it's wrong to, fawn over a murderous, brutal thug dictator.
But this is the point that people have abandoned principles. So there's a principle. You don't negotiate. You don't compromise with evil. Not if it's Arafat, not if it's Hamas, not if it's Al-Qaeda, not if it's the Iranian regime, and not if it's the monster from North Korea. You don't negotiate with evil. And if you want to know why, look at what happens when you do. Look at what happens in the schoolyard with a bully. Look at what happens in business. Imagine, here's the thing to imagine. Imagine there's a company out there that you know are crooks. And you say, but their products are really cheap. But they're crooks. Do you go and negotiate a price with them? Do you sit down and play 4D chess with them? I mean, what? Give me a break.
What could you possibly gain?
There's nothing to gain, exactly.
It was interesting. Someone on my Instagram was saying, they said, because I asked this question. It was, you know, if Kim Jong-un loves his people, what does it look like if he hates them? Which is an interesting thing to ask,
yes,
right?
Yes. I mean, there's still people here saying he's not fawning, he's negotiating. No, my friends, he is fawning. He is a short-term, concrete-bound, emotionless, thug. And that's what Trump, and he is fawning over a dictator, a brutal dictator. He's legitimizing him. He's sanctioning him. He's giving him credibility. And he is the real destruction is to the North Korean people. They're the ones who are going to suffer the consequence of this. There will be blood in the streets because of what Trump is doing. And again, go study history. This has always been the case.
Yeah. Someone had argued something like, well, negotiating isn't possible without making nice. And my response is,
true. You don't negotiate with evil, period.
Well,
you just don't negotiate.
So the whole point is negotiating isn't actually possible unless the person that you're negotiating with has the characteristics that make making nice appropriate. So somehow they think that if, you know, Trump makes nice with Kim Jong-un, that's going to create the characteristics within Kim Jong-un that's going to make him somebody worth negotiating with, that we can actually achieve something by a negotiation, which brings the final point, which is, no, we don't believe that the only alternative to this is nuclear war. However, suppose it was the case that they're saying, look, you got to fawn over this guy and stroke this guy's quote unquote ego. Otherwise, nuclear war. Choose in that case. I choose nuclear war,
but it's a false choice because
it's never like that.
Somebody
like,
says,
who wants to live that
Yuan, you don't, I mean, this guy says, Yuan, you don't realize that there are millions of innocent lives at stake. Really? I don't realize that? Give me a break. I mean, I've actually laid out the whole scenario of North Korea. I, you know, it's Trump that doesn't realize this. Because what Trump is doing right now is he is solidifying Kim's dictatorial rule over North Korea. Instead of working to get rid of Kim, instead of working in the shadows to isolate Kim, to completely embargo him, working with the Chinese, not on tariffs, but on actually complete isolation of Kim and that regime, and ultimately leading long-term to freedom for the North Koreans, instead of that, he is legitimizing him. He's saying, no, Kim, you are the legitimate leader of North Korea, and you're a tough guy, and you're actually quite a nice guy. And people stand up, and people show you respect. I admire that. This is...
loves his people.
I cannot... I mean, as much as I hated Trump before this, right? And granted, a lot of American presidents would have met with Kim, although everybody refused up until now. Remember... Kim has wanted to meet, or his father wanted to meet with every American president. So this has never been a problem of them not wanting to meet with us. It's us not wanting to meet with them.
Historic.
Not just that he met with them. I get that. You know, Trump will do that. But what he said is so disgusting. It's so despicable. It's so beneath an American president. It's so beneath an American to support it that I don't – that to me – you know, I just don't get how you can support this. I just don't get how you people out there can support this from your leader, from your representative, to say the kind of things he said and to legitimize the kind of brutal regime.
I think it's because they think that he doesn't mean it, obviously.
Doesn't matter. It means nothing.
It's just a quote negotiation tactic because otherwise the option is nuclear war and you can't be for killing everybody.
But that's stupid. When Trump was talking about Rocket Man and talking about all these things, then all these people supported him. They thought he was great. The fact that he was, through stupid language, maybe bringing us towards closer to the brink of war, they thought was great. So at that point, they love nuclear war, and indeed, if Trump had said, if his general had said, Mathis had said, we can take out these North Koreans, we're going to crush them, and if a million North Koreans have to die, so be it, but we're going to liberate North Korea and defend, then these people would have cheered and danced in the streets and supported him. And now
that's the thing, is that, you know, on Twitter this morning, he's talking about how loyal his supporters are, and indeed they are, and
that's not an American characteristic, loyalty.
Usually you would be allied with people insofar as they share values with you.
So let me emphasize, North Korea will never attack the United States with nuclear weapons. It has nothing to gain by doing that and everything to lose. They don't believe they get 72 virgins if they die, so why would they want to die? The United States has the technology. It's not perfected, but it's pretty good to shoot most of those missiles out of the sky. We could, through covert action, I believe, probably slow down the development of ballistic missiles in North Korea to a point where it's not a threat to the United States. And then if we really wanted to take out the North Korean regime, we could do it without using one single nuke. We could have taken them out. They have 30 nuclear bombs that they have deployed on their land that they can't take anywhere, they can't launch anywhere. What are they going to set one off in North Korea? So the whole idea that there's no military option is not true. The idea that millions have to die is not true. But the idea that there has to be a military option is not true. The fact is, you isolate him. We've been doing it for 30 years. We could continue doing it. The idea, and let me put it again. You do not negotiate with evil. You don't do it in business. You don't do it in your personal lives. And you do not You don't do it with police. Police don't negotiate with or shouldn't at least, with serial killers. And you do not negotiate with brutal leaders of countries that where they are brutal, where they are dictators and brutal. We shouldn't have negotiated. I said this the other day. We shouldn't have negotiated with Stalin. FDR should not have met with Stalin. Nixon should not have met with Mao Zedong. Ayn Rand has a beautiful passage describing the evil of that and how horrible it was for the Chinese who watched this.
Mm-hmm.
And just everybody, nobody accused me of being a Trump lover. No, a Obama lover. Obama should have not, under any circumstances, met with Castro and gone to Cuba. I mean, that was despicable, disgusting. And again, you should have been horrified by what your president was doing. But the left fawned over that when he did it with Cuba. And it looks like the right, or so-called right, is fawning over it when it's done in North Korea. So there we are.
Yeah.
All right.
Three more things from the essay.
We have to end at 30 past. So
okay, that's fine. Right. That's fine. And we want to get on to a couple positive stories too. So one is just an interesting observation. At the time, Rand was happy that a propaganda effort to make people fear fascism but not communism had failed. She says, you know, thankfully Americans hate both communism and fascism. Of course, now the problem is that people don't fear fascism enough, I think.
Well, and young people are enamored with socialism. So I think on both fronts, we are seeing Americans drifting in both directions. So there are people here in the chat who admire Hungary and Poland, and they drift towards, you know, fascist, socialist, however you want to call it, but towards authoritarian government. And certainly young people think socialism is just this wonderful thing where everybody gets free healthcare and we all live in kind of a Scandinavian utopia. So I think there's ignorance in it, but there is a certain sense of, there's much more of a sense of entitlement in America, a sense of expecting to get answers from above, which socialism and fascism provide.
Another one is ecology. She was skeptical that environmentalism or the ecology movement would succeed.
I think she's right in many respects. I was just reading today an article by saying, you know, global warming's over. Nobody cares. Nobody cares. I mean, nobody really cares. They all say they care, but they're not willing to do anything about it. Nobody, the left, the right, nobody's actually willing to do anything about it. The Paris Accord was weak. It didn't really have much teeth to it. It didn't require people to do anything very dramatic. It's all so I think she's right there. Look, environmentalism has creeped along. It's the boiling fog, right? It's in the boiling water. It's kind of creeped along, and so they ban plastic bags here. But when it really is progress or the environment, Americans still choose progress for the most part.
How is it in Puerto Rico in that regard, by the way? Do you have to do the 10 cents extra for plastic bags and all that stuff?
I think we have plastic bags. We do have plastic bags. I don't know. I don't think we do. I think we're too poor to impose that on people, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
Somebody
okay.
says here, never do this, never do that. Far too simplistic in the real world. No, it's exact opposite. I encourage all of you to read Leonard Peikoff's brilliant essay on why what you think on principle. It's because the real world is so complex that you need principles and you stick to principles. The idea that the way to face complexity is without principles is you might as well put a gun to your head and pull the trigger. So it's because of the complexity of the world you need principles, and principles are not simplistic. That's always been the accusation against objectivism and accusation against principled thinking. Oh, that's just simplistic. Bullshit. You know, it's not simplistic. It's actually, principles are a massive achievement. It's an achievement to integrate all the data that you have into certain truths that you always stick by, that you don't just change whenever you feel like. That's the principles of morality. You don't, you know, life's too complicated. Sometimes you have to lie. Life's too complicated. Sometimes you have to be an emotionalist. Life's too complicated. Sometimes you have to not have integrity. Life's too complicated. Why be independent all the time? Sometimes other people are better. Jesus Christ. I mean, Principles are the only appropriate way for human beings to live. And the accusations are simplistic. Simplistic.
Yeah, I was naive. I was told yesterday out there on Twitter.
Yes.
They're all patting me on the back for.
Yes, well, anything principled is naive. It's simplistic. It's, you know, you can't do that. And you have to just go with the flow. You have to go with the concrete examples that you have right now, because they change all the time, and reality is always in flux. What was that Greek philosopher who said everything's in flux?
Heraclitus, right?
Heraclitus, right? It's all in flux. There's nothing real. There's nothing true. So you just go with it.
Final one. And here's the one that got me, because of something that Trump had said fairly recently. Rand talks about Americans not having any sense of fundamental guilt themselves about the country, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so what came to my mind, of course, was Trump. I think he was saying this in the context of Putin and Russia, right? We're not so great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He has this attitude of we're just like them, which is exactly the attitude Obama had, right? And everybody, you know, all of the same people who now praise him, everybody accused Obama of it, the moral equivalency between us and everybody else. And yet when Trump does it, nobody cares. I mean, it's exactly what he said about Putin. Everybody kills, you know, we kill people too. Putin killed people. We're the same as Russia. We're the same as Saudi Arabia. We're the same as these countries. There's no difference. We're the same as North Korea, I guess. Except there, people set up a detention, and here they don't. So maybe they're a little better than us. Maybe.
So this exercise of going through the essay, Yaron, has it made you more or less optimistic?
Well, I'm afraid it's, you know, I don't know. I mean, this is why the talk is hard for me.
Again,
yes,
all of those
are true.
Are in that essay. Don't let it go.
Don't let it go in philosophy who needs it, Ayn Rand's essay. And it might be on campus, that essay, for free. I'm not sure.
Could be.
But also, Why One Should Act on Principle is definitely on campus and free. So no excuse not to read that. You can go to campus.aynrand.org and look up Why One Should Act on Principle by Leonard Peikoff. It's one of the really required readings in objectivism. If you really want to understand objectivism, that's one of the essays you have to read, because it really, I mean, philosophy is about principles. It's the objectivist epistemology. It connects the objectivist epistemology with objectivist ethics, with the nature of reality, with metaphysics. So, Why One Should Act on Principle. This is why I'm torn, right? So on the one hand, I get the role of ideas in history. And based on that, kind of, you have to say the ideas in the culture suck, and therefore the world is in decline, and this is all going to end badly, and well, you know, it's futile. What's the point, right? You have to be pessimistic. And that, in a sense, is what Leonard does in Damn. I mean, he does it with real depth and real philosophy. And I agree with that, right? And I agree with that. On the other hand, the world we live in is unprecedented. There's never been anything like it. From a material wealth perspective, from an individual liberties perspective, from a free speech perspective even. We've never been this free. In spite of all the economic, I mean, as a globe, as a world, not as a United States, as a world. Mm-hmm. We've never had so much freedom. We've never spoken so much. We've never had such cheap and available means of communication. We've never had so much wealth. I mean, it's not even, never is not, I mean, all the wealth accumulated over the whole 100,000 first years of humanity up to two funds, accumulated all together, doesn't even touch what we've done in the last 250 years. Technology is advancing, digital technology at least, is advancing at just an unbelievable rate. People love technology. People love their stuff. People love their material well-being and their lifestyle. And more people in the world are loving this. More people in the world are becoming like this. And there's a sense in which ideology is dead. Nobody's a real communist. Nobody's a real fascist, right? And this is Leonard's point about ultimately there has to be a M2, a massive misintegration, a new ideology that people rally around, because otherwise, and the world is becoming more secular, I think. I mean, I don't know that, and even America is at least for now, I still think America has the real danger of becoming much more religious, but at least in the short run, it looks like it's becoming more secular. I think it's going to take much longer for the bad ideas, particularly given that they're not consistently ideological, they're not to have the negative impact. I think the fact that people love their technology and love their material well-being will be a pragmatic bulwark against all that. I think the internet gives us means of communication we've never had before, and people are not going to want to give that up. I think there's a good chance that for the next 50 years, we kind of drift without a clear dominant philosophy, without anything clear and dominant, but we drift and the economy actually improves, because as Asia wakes up and ultimately as Africa wakes up, we in America, our standard of living can rise just because by trading with them, which is why I'm so offended by tariffs, because the United States has benefited. People in America have benefited unbelievably from trade with China, and there's very, very few economists who would disagree with that statement. The standard of living of Americans is dramatically higher because of China than if China wasn't here. And if Africa then becomes productive, our standard of living will go up, even if we do nothing new. I just think that dynamic, and on top of that, if you add all the stuff that Steven Pinker documents, there's less crime today. There's less wars today. There's less violence today. There's less rape today. There's less – everything bad is less today. There's less diseases today. We have cures for them, and we're about – the other thing about biotech, we're about to – there's a good chance that we're about to hit this acceleration in biotech that's gonna just provide us with cures for almost everything that ails us. And I really think it's
if medicine remains free enough to do that.
Yeah, but there's no indication that the research in medicine is going to be that controlled. If you talk to people in the cancer field, research in cancer has actually been freed up over the last few decades. It's just easier to get a cancer drug to market. There are other things that are harder. So there's, again, I'm trying not to be Pollyannish, but I'm just saying These are the things you have to weigh against. So we're going to live to be 200. The economy is going to do okay. Not great, but okay. The real evil is what could have been. How rich we could be. How happy we could be. How aesthetically amazing the world could be, if not for the shitty philosophy and culture that we have. I'm just not convinced that we're heading off a cliff right now. And if you look at the stats, if you just look at the state of the world, again, we live in the best world ever. Now, you can't quantify the value of the aesthetic experience of living in the 19th century or the aesthetic experience of being in Rome. But take being a woman in Rome, in Greece. You wouldn't want to be a woman in Greece. So there are at least 50% of the population are much better off today than in Greece, right? 19th century. You don't want to be a woman in the 19th century. You don't want to be black in the 19th century. So there's a huge percentage of the population, that, again, in spite of all the statism, the regulation, the controls, much better off today, right? Yeah. So how do you weigh all that? I think if you weigh it all properly, objectively, this is still the best time to ever be alive in human history because we can access all the good stuff that was back then. So how can you be pessimistic, right? So as individuals, you have – well, anyway, this is my – I'm going to give the talk at OCA. I'm not going to give it now.
Yes.
That's just an outline.
Yeah, and we're going to go pretty soon anyway. But what I want to do – well, there's a couple things, you know, again
– let me just answer this question because it's what do you call it? Dollars are attached to it. Do you think that there will always be a sense of envy of wealth – even 100 years from now, when the poor people in the future are incredibly wealthy in comparison to present? No. With the right philosophy, envy gets eradicated for the most part. There will always be envious people. But as a phenomena, as a cultural force, envy is a product of philosophy. Socialists are envious. Nationalists are envious. Collectivists of all form are envious. So to really eradicate envy, you have to be an individualist. So with the rise of individualism, envy will disappear as a cultural force. All right, go for it,
okay.
Amy.
Couple of concrete things for people to look at. You know, again, all of the stuff that we were just talking about with the essay, Don't Let It Go, is for people just to think about characteristics of Americans and how those have fared under Trump and what Trump might be doing to either further or erode them. But let's talk about a couple of concretes. One of them is the article you sent, Yaron. Trump's tariffs are already backfiring. And it talks about the effect of the tariffs on washing machine imports.
Yeah, this is bad news, not good news.
Yes.
But it just shows all of you people who don't believe the laws of economics actually work. It shows that the laws of economics are predicted by me and pretty much every other economist in the world work. And when you place tariffs on washing machines, what happened is the washing machines domestically go up in price. And what happened here is the price of washing machines have gone up a whopping 17%. Now, who do you think is going to suffer from that? Well, the fact is, I probably won't. I can afford an extra 17% on my washing machine. But it's poor, lower middle class Americans who are maybe starting to raise a family or buying their first home. They're young, they're ambitious, and now they have to spend an extra 17% on washing machines. Why? Because American washing machine companies, I think there are two of them, lobbied the Trump administration to impose tariffs because they didn't want to compete with LG and Samsung.
Mm-hmm.
So who are the losers? All of us. And
everybody.
particularly middle class and lower income, but we don't care about them, right? We just want American jobs in washing machine industries. But the cost to this, when you pay 17% more for an expensive item like washing machines, that's significant money you're not able to spend on other important things in your life. It is a crime. It is despicable. And the idea that Trump continues with this and there's not a massive, massive, massive outcry is absurd. You know, somebody says free trade is taken on faith. What faith? I just gave you an example of where you raise tariffs.
If you look at that article, whoever that person is, the article is in the link at the program notes, don'tletitgo.com. Yep. In the article, it tells you statistically how much it costs to create each job that supposedly has been saved. It's like hundreds of thousands of dollars per job, where the job, the salary of it is much less than that.
Government could just hire people. We could do Bernie Sanders' solution, where everybody gets a government job who can't find a job elsewhere and just have full employment that way. It's better. That would be better. I would support Sanders' solution over tariffs.
It's ridiculous, the inefficiency and horror. And it talks about in there also how those companies, LG and Samsung or whatever, they kept relocating their manufacturing according to, trying to escape the tariffs. So just think of all the destruction of wealth and productive capacity due
and as a
to
consequence
government
of jobs.
Force inserted in here.
And a consequence, and as a consequence, we lose jobs. So you don't gain jobs. Tariffs reduce the number of jobs domestically. There's no question about it. Steel tariffs might save some steel jobs, but there are 40 times more jobs in companies that use steel. More jobs are destroyed than are created.
Yep.
It's just, anyway.
No, anyway.
What was the last story?
So there's another news story, which is just, and it's not clear how it's going to play out, but there's a concern, right? Parts of Obamacare have been invalidated, removed, made ineffectual by Trump, right?
Yep.
So we don't have the individual mandate. And then this link that I've got in the program notes talks about a federal appeals court has now denied insurers billions in so-called risk corridor payments. And what that means is insurance companies were told if they take on high-risk consumers,
the government would subsidize it.
Subsidize, but now the government is not having to subsidize. Appeals court says, sorry, insurers, you're left high and dry. Now, what could happen, because again, we don't have a dominant philosophy and Trump tends towards the altruist, let's insure everybody. Suppose everything collapses. We could have a socialized medicine system under Trump if things collapse.
Yeah.
Is this going to cause everything to collapse? It's quite possible, right? Because here's these insurance companies, they take on all the high risk, all the obligation because of government guarantees, and now that's been ripped out from under them. So
absolutely,
it's just something to watch. We don't know the costs of the tariffs like we do with that.
Health insurance is going to collapse here. It's just a question of time. And and the outcome of that is potentially single
uncertain.
Payout.
It's
awful. But again, nobody seems to care. Stock market's up. Weather's good. I'm going to the beach. How about you, Amy?
You're going to go to the beach pretty quick here?
I am.
I've got a couple items of some good news I can leave you with.
So do those quick 2 minutes, because then I've got another call with somebody at 3:30, and then I'm going to the beach.
Okay.
I really am going to the beach, guys.
I'm happy for you that you get to do that. And
I haven't been to the beach
all
in
all this
Puerto
stuff,
Rica,
and then you're
going to
give us a great talk in a few weeks
right.
at OCON. So one of the pieces of good news, I think, is that Apple is continuing to close security holes in our iPhones. So there was some security hole that has been using to crack into iPhones, you know, bypass the encryption and everything. And Apple is, again, now going to close this. I guess they left it open longer than some people thought they should or whatever,
yep.
but they're
yep.
continuing to do this. They're
Good.
Continuing to fight
Good.
On our behalf and our privacy and
Good
our rights.
For Apple.
And then the last one is, here's a woman in Iran
yep.
who is demonstrating.
She's more American than many of these Americans.
Exactly. Yep. Demonstrating the American sense of life, demonstrating the defiance in the face of overbearing authority. She was told by the so-called moral police in Iran that she should be wearing her hijab correctly. And go ahead, go to that tweet, because it's got a video. You can see what she
yep.
does. When she's told
Well, describe it, because then we're going to, with this, we're going to end the show.
Okay. Well, everybody go look at this after the show. It's at don'tletitgo.com. She rips it off entirely. Yeah. And says, who are you?
Yeah. Who are you? That's the key. All right. Thank you, Amy. Good show. We've now, hopefully next week, we won't have to talk about Trump, because I think in the state of the world, because we've covered it all. We've said everything there is to say. I hope something really new.
Maybe
new bad
Carpenter
doesn't happen.
Will come down this week, and that's going to be the thing I'm going to want to talk to you about a
Who
lot
comes,
next week.
Oh, Carpenter.
Carpenter
that's right.
is the cell phone okay. privacy case.
Yeah,
we keep
good.
Waiting.
Yeah, good.
Keep waiting for the Supreme Court to release that opinion. It might be this week.
All right. So we'll see Amy again on Saturday. The rest of you, follow me on Facebook, Twitter, but most importantly, YouTube. Subscribe to my YouTube channel. We're over 10,000 nicely. And Patreon. We are close to my goal. We should hit the goal by the end of June, which is $6,000 a month. So we're really, really close. So please go on there and subscribe and on Patreon. And Amy, go to follow Amy on Facebook, Twitter, particularly Twitter. Amy does really good work on Twitter. YouTube. And she has a Patreon site as well. So patreon.com. What is it? Patreon.com.
Amy Peacock. Yeah,
Amy Peacock. So
yeah.
Support Amy's work as well, and we'll see you all. You'll probably see me sooner, but you'll see me and Amy together a week from today. Talk to you later, guys. Bye.
Thanks, Yaron.
Thanks, Amy.